So the theme of the retreat has been mindfulness of the body as a doorway to wisdom and compassion, about which Richard spoke beautifully and most touchingly yesterday as body as a teacher. And happily I can tell you that the talk was recorded, so if any of you want to listen to his talk again, it will be available to you on Audio Dharma. So, the body. I wanted to start my talk by sharing a poem with you. It's called Living in the Body by Joyce Sutphen. Body is something you need in order to stay on this planet, and you only get one. And no matter which one you get, it will not be satisfactory. It will not be beautiful enough. It will not be fast enough. It will not keep on for days at a time, but will pull you down into a sleepy swamp and demand apples and coffee and chocolate cake. Mine was quite happy with the cupcakes at lunch today, this body. Body is a thing you have to carry from one day into the next. Always the same eyebrows over the same eyes in the same skin when you look in the mirror, and the same creaky knee when you get up from the floor, and the same wrist under the watch band. The changes you can make are small and costly, better to leave it as it is. Body's a thing that you have to leave eventually. You know that because you have seen others do it. Others who were once like you, living inside their pile of bones and flesh, smiling at you, loving you, leaning in the doorway, talking to you for hours, and then one day, they are gone. No forwarding address. So body as a teacher, mindfulness of the body, teaching us in so many ways. Mindfulness of body, kaya gatasati. It's not a second-class practice, you know. It's not like we're giving you a simple practice. Oh yeah, we're keeping the secret, the really like highbrow mindfulness of mind practices for the graduate. It's doing the mindfulness of body practice can actually open you up and take you all the way to Nibbana, to liberation. There is so much that can open up from this practice. And also, as I mentioned in my previous talk, with the four foundations of mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta, it's the sutta from which most of the teachings that you hear on retreats are drawn from, most of the instructions, like the morning instructions we give you about the body and breath and body scan and emotions and feeling tone, they're drawn, when you come here or go to Spirit Rock, you know, when you go on 7-day retreats, there is an unfolding of the instructions that are drawn from the Satipatthana Sutta, from the four foundations of mindfulness. Also, if your entry to this practice has been from the secular mindfulness world, and some of you teach that also, guess what? Most of the teachings are drawn from the Satipatthana Sutta. So it's a really important teaching in this tradition, in Buddhism in general. So the first foundation, as I mentioned, the first foundation is the body. Is the first foundation, is the most important one, is the most accessible one, is the first one. And then through the first one, you can when you've really mastered the first one, it opens you up to the other ones. Of course, you can practice the other ones too on their own, but it's going through the body as a doorway is really the most straightforward, the most balanced, stable, the most embodied way to both go through life and also experience the teachings. So I wanted to just share a little bit about the Satipatthana Sutta. And the four foundations of mindfulness. And then I wanted to spend some time answering as many questions as I could. You were quite prolific, thank you. You left me a lot of questions. I guess I asked nicely with sugar on top this morning. You did leave me a lot of questions, thank you. So I'll speak a little bit about that first. And that actually you're welcome well, we'll see how that goes, how many questions I'll get to answer. So the first foundation of mindfulness, the body, there are actually six different practices, six different body practices in the Satipatthana Sutta. And we've mentioned some of them, not so formally in 1, 2, 3, but we've talked about them. I'll give you the list just so that you know what the body practices are, the Satipatthana Sutta. The first one is breathing. Surprise, surprise. You've heard us talk about that. Breathing, really feeling the breath in the body as an anchor, exploring the breath. The second practice is awareness, mindfulness of posture, whether you're sitting or standing or walking or lying down, simply being aware of the body in that posture. That's simply knowing that you're sitting and breathing, simply that. And I brought that, some of you might remember, I brought that into the instructions yesterday morning. Simply know that you're sitting and breathing. Just that's enough. Simply knowing, being mindful, being aware, fully aware. Sitting and breathing. A lot of times in my practice, that's enough. Sometimes when I want to keep it really simple, I just know that I'm sitting and breathing. Very simple. Very simple. Nothing fancy. The third body practice in the Satipatthana Sutta is mindfulness of activities. Being mindful of what you're doing as you're walking, as you're making a cup of tea, as you're going to the bathroom, as you're washing the dishes, as you're closing the door to your room. Just mindfulness of what activity you're doing. When you're putting on your clothes, when you're urinating, defecating, all of that is actually included. So being mindful of what activity you're doing. And we brought that in also very gently. Again, it's a short retreat. We just dropped that in. The continuity, being mindful as you're going through your day, mindful of what it is you're doing, mindfulness of activities. The fourth body practice is a contemplation, actually. It's a contemplation of anatomical parts of the body. And this is known as the practice of the 32 parts of the body. Actually, that is an answer to one of the questions that was asked, so I'll relate them to. So let me tell you what this practice actually is, the contemplation. So the anatomical parts of the body, basically, I'll read the list to you first. So the 32 parts of the body meditation goes like this. You contemplate each of these parts. Starts with head hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, large intestine, small intestine, stomach, feces, brain. I like how brain is after feces. feces, brain, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat. Pretty exciting, hey? So what is the point of this practice? And is the practice I've done actually intensely with my teacher, Pak Sayadaw. And we were just talking the other day, Bob Stahl, whose sangha is in Santa Cruz and also teaches nationally and internationally. He teaches a 32 body parts of the body course every year, and he teaches a retreat at Spirit Rock, and he has his own way. So why? Well, it sounds kind of esoteric, like sitting and contemplating your head hair and body hair and your nails and your teeth and your skin. Like, okay, these Buddhists are really weird. Like, what's that? So this practice, actually, this particular body practice has multiple multiple outcomes. One is that you start to see a body for what it is. It starts, because we have so much attachment to our body, both attachment and we love it, we hate it, or have just such a complicated relationship. And we start to see the body as its part, as its constituents. We see it as nature. And then we start to see it actually like a bag of beans, the same way that a bag of beans is just, it's bunch of beans. It's just a bunch of beans. They're functional. They're beans. They're not beautiful. They're not ugly. They're beans. They're functional. And you start to see your body. Oh yeah, lungs, brain, kidneys. Yeah, you start to see them both in your own body and in the other people. You start to see them. You start to see this body as nature. You start to see this body for what it is. You start to become, lose that enchantment of yourself, of this body that you might have. And it's a really powerful practice that the monks do as one of their initiation practices. And it's also what is suggested as an antidote for if you're overwhelmed by sexual desire and sexual fantasy. So imagine you're sitting on the cushion, you're overwhelmed by sexual desire and fantasy and the image of this very exciting person with their body comes to mind. Now start, so invoking this practice becomes you start to see them, head hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin. You start to see them in constituents, and soon enough, I promise you, any attraction, any desire, any lust you had will go away. You'll see them as a bag of beans, as functional. I've done this practice. It's really powerful. I've been assailed. It's in sexual desire, sexual fantasy. We're all human beings. It happens. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's okay. And sometimes, it comes, you see it like, thank you, not now. And then it keeps coming and it keeps coming. It's like, oh my goodness. And then you pull out the 32 parts of the body. Like, okay, now I'm armed. Now, then you start to do this practice and it's like, ah, sexual fantasy runs away. It just cannot kind of survive the 32 parts of the body meditation. If for any of you it survives that, let me know. We'll have a chat. I'll be impressed. So if you don't, but if you're interested in this practice, but the 32 parts just kind of seems overwhelming and you don't even know where to start, there's a simplification of it that Bhikkhu Anayo teaches. And that is, you can simply reduce it to three parts, skin, flesh, bones. And that's enough. You can just contemplate skin. You can really contemplate skin covering the body, skin. It's just skin, flesh, oh yeah, flesh, all these muscles, flesh, and then bones, the skeleton, bones, functional. And this contemplation, by the way, in the Satipatthana Sutta, all these contemplations are supposed to be done both internally and externally. That is, you can do them both internally for your own, internally for your body, for example, and externally. So the 32 parts or the simplification, 3 parts can be done internally, contemplating your own body or contemplating other people's bodies. So the body practices in Satipatthana Sutta mention breathing, posture, awareness of posture, awareness of activities. And by the way, posture and activities, these two are really simple, easy mindfulness, body mindfulness practices you can take home, which is another question. I'm kind of fitting in some of the questions asked. Another question that was asked was about how to practice at home, how to take the practice home. So one way, we'll say more about this, but one way is mindfulness of the body in a way of knowing when you're sitting, when you're walking, knowing your posture, knowing your activities, when you're washing the dishes, that's what I'm doing right now. Etc. Very simple, and doing one thing at a time, not multitasking, because it kind of becomes a little complicated. The mind gets to multitasking actually, and we all multitask. Multitasking actually makes the mind more jumpy. I notice it in myself. And there are many scientific studies, by their research studies, showing that when we multitask, first of all, we're less productive. We think we're more productive, but the time that we spend in context switching, the mind spends in switching context from this to that, from this, it actually takes longer than if we're doing each task alone. And our mind becomes much more flighty. I notice that in my own mind. That when I do multitask, it's just my mind is much harder for it to settle down, to get it to do one thing. It gets pretty nervous. See that for yourself. Anyway, back to the list of the practices: so breathing, posture, activities, anatomical parts, which is the 32 parts of the body, or the 3 parts. Take your pick. The fourth one in the Satipatthana Sutta out of the body practices are the elements. They're called the 4 elements. And basically, one way that this is practiced and one way that the 4 elements meditation is practiced is by experiencing the raw sensations of the body as the elements of earth, fire, water, wind, which seems like what? But it's just the raw sensations of heat, or pressure, the way I was leading you yesterday morning, feeling the pressure, feeling the hardness, feeling softness, feeling tingling, feeling movement, feeling, so those raw sensations, feeling the raw sensations of the body is one way that the 4 elements meditation is practiced and taught. There are other ways, but that's one way that can really keep you grounded and keep you, can open up to not an idea, not a conceptual idea of experience of a body, but a raw sensation from the inside. And the 4 elements practice, when you practice it for a while and it really starts to get juicy for you, the mind starts to see, starts to feel the body as points in space. And the idea of bodiness kind of goes away. And it just feels like this points of sensation somewhere out there in space. There's just these points of sensation and there is no sense of a body anywhere. The body disappears. It's just points of sensation. And that can open one up to what we assume to be an experience of the body. It can feel like being in the Matrix, the movie The Matrix. So I can say more about that, but maybe I'll leave that for as an exercise for people who are curious to continue with this practice of the body and the sensations, the raw sensations. What does it actually feel like to have a body? What if it was just this points in space? The sixth and the last body contemplation in the Satipatthana Sutta is actually a death contemplation. As Richard beautifully brought it in yesterday. And this one is actually taught as contemplating a corpse, contemplating a corpse that is decaying. And it could be your own corpse, imagining your own corpse going through the stages of decay, or imagining another corpse. And in fact, there are the practices of looking at photographs, or I've heard at monasteries when there is an animal that's dead, actually the monks visit it every day to see it go through the stages of decay as a practice, as a way to see that, oh, this body too, this body is only nature. It's going to go through the same exact process of decay, to bring that in. To bring in the feeling of urgency, of both making peace with this body's death, leaving without an address, no forwarding address, just as the poem said. So I want to also mention, so the six practices of the body in the Satipatthana Sutta, I'll review them one more time: breathing, posture, activities, anatomical parts, elements, four elements, and corpse and decay. So through body practices, through mindfulness of the body, through being present with this body, as we've been talking about, it can open us up to actually the other practices, to the other foundations of mindfulness. The second one, the second foundation of mindfulness in the Satipatthana Sutta is called Vedana. The Pali word is Vedana, which is feeling tone. So I don't like the translation as feeling tone, because it feels like feelings. It's not that. It's anything but that. It has nothing to do with emotions. It has nothing to do with feelings. It's very simply pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. It's the experience of mind when something is pleasant. So, for example, as you're sitting here, say, sitting with your body, noticing your body, notice something that's pleasant in your body. Just that. That feeling of pleasantness. That's a feeling tone. That's a Vedana of pleasant. Now notice something that's not so pleasant. Okay, that feeling of unpleasantness, and it doesn't have to be big. It's just like, right now I'm feeling a little sweaty. I'm giving a talk. Okay, so that is a little unpleasant. Okay. And then now notice something that up to now you hadn't noticed in your body. It's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's just, it's okay. It's kind of under the radar. Let's see, I can bring my attention, say, to my lips. Huh, I hadn't even noticed them. They're just there. I sense them. There's a sensation there, but it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So that, Vedana is just that. Not complicated. Body can be an amazing doorway to explore Vedana, because through the body will supply us with endless supply of pleasant, unpleasant, and neither unpleasant nor unpleasant, which we shorthanded for as just as neutral. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. You can explore the second foundation of mindfulness through the body endlessly. So why is that important? Well, for example, when we're working with pain, as I was mentioning in my talk previously, we can notice that there are sensations when we label it as pain, we label it as this big package called pain, but it's actually sensations, raw sensations of pulling, pushing, tight, heat, fire. And then separate from that, there is unpleasantness, and often pretty strong unpleasantness, but it's not the same. They're separate, they're different. And then usually separate from that also is aversion. I don't like this. Make it go away. And then sometimes in the package wrapped in the same present with a bow on top, we get a fourth element, which is the story. Why me? Why is this happening to me? It's my fault, or it's somebody else's fault. It's my doctor's fault. They're not doing their best they can. It's the medications. It's just like the stories. Stories, all kinds of stories. But actually, these are different elements. And through the body, we can actually see that, oh yeah, Vedana, the feeling tone, is just unpleasant. It's just unpleasant. And oh yeah, unpleasant, I don't like it. That's kind of, that leads to that. And then the stories, we can separate them all. So the body can serve as the doorway for this profound teaching, which is seeing the pleasantness and unpleasantness and neutrality just as that, and not letting them push you and shove you and take you on the trip here and there. Because when you see it for what it is, then you just see that, oh, it's just unpleasant. It's just unpleasant. It doesn't bother you anymore. Or you also similarly see pleasant experiences are just pleasant. You enjoy them. Yeah, great, enjoy them. Buddhism is not supposed to be killjoy. So enjoy the pleasant experiences and don't get attached to them. Because if you get attached to them and if you want more of the pleasant, that's where the pain comes. That's where the, oh, I want more of this. That's where the dukkha comes. But if you just enjoy it, oh yeah, it's lovely. It's delightful. Yum. And it goes away. Okay, that's fine. It doesn't bother you as much, right? There's freedom in that. That's where the freedom comes in. It's just unpleasant. It's just pleasant. No need to run after the pleasant. Enjoy it, relish it, and then let it go with an open hand. It's fine. And the unpleasantness, the unpleasant, is just unpleasant. One thing that can be experienced, and I remember one retreatant told me this some retreats ago, what they had seen in their practice was, at some point, for them, there was no difference between pleasant and unpleasant. It was just pleasant. It was just unpleasant. Just that. And the mind can see that. Every single one of your minds can see that. And the body can open you up to see pleasant as just pleasant, and unpleasant just as unpleasant. And neutral usually goes under the radar because many things are labeled as neutral by our minds. And also to say the pleasant and unpleasant and neutral are often not a function of the experience, but it's how the mind labels them. A story I've often told is this became really, really clear to me years ago, beginning of my practice. I had heard about the Vedana, this feeling tone, and I don't know about your experience with clocks, the clocks that make the tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock sound. But I didn't have a very friendly relationship with them. My experience had been, you know, staying at relatives or friends' place, and you know, there's usually a guest room and there's a clock and it's late at night and you're trying to fall asleep and the tick-tock, tick-tock, it just sounds louder and louder and louder and trying to figure out how to go to sleep. Anybody has had that experience or just... Yeah, oh, look at that. Cool. Yeah, I'm not the only one. Yeah, so that was my association with TikTok. It was just not a very pleasant one. And I remember after learning this teaching, I was sitting and I was in a room where there was this clock that was tick, 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 making sounds. And again, it's unpleasant, unpleasant. I started noticing unpleasant, 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 still unpleasant, unpleasant, unpleasant. And then it switched all of a sudden. All of a sudden, it switched. All of a sudden, it started to be pleasant. I was contemplating this teaching. All of a sudden, the tick, tick, tick started to be pleasant. And it sounded like the most interesting sound, most interesting symphony I had ever heard became tick, tock, tick, tock. Wow, that was so interesting. It was the same sound. In one moment it was unpleasant, the next moment it was pleasant, and then it changed again. It became neutral. It was neither driving me crazy nor giving me great joy. It was just a sound. So it was so interesting to see how the mind labels things as pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, and it's not inherent in the object of experience. So, body contemplations, body mindfulness of the body can open us up really to experience the feeling tone, Vedana. And the third Satipatthana is mindfulness of mind states, mindfulness of mind states, mindfulness of mind. And when we have enough stability in our body, when we're grounded enough in the body, that allows us to then really become more tuned to the states of mind that are arising, to the difficult states, to the higher states, and also those states often, as we've talked about it, those states have a ramification, they have a manifestation in the body. Emotions, for example, don't just show up in the mind, they show up in the body. And for example, with working with emotions, we let go of the story and we investigate in the body. That's what investigation means here, really feeling them in the body. What do they feel like? And last but not the least, obviously, is the fourth foundation of mindfulness, known as dhammas, or mental objects. And there are five of them: hindrances, aggregates, and I won't go through this actually much. Hindrances, we've talked about sleepiness, for example, working with sleepiness. And the aggregates of experience, body being one of them, and the sense sphere, the five senses, and guess what? The five senses are through the body, experienced through the body. The awakening factors, which are these beautiful qualities of the mind and heart, which again, if there is stability of mindfulness of the body, one can really experience them. They really arise with more ease. And the four noble truths that again can be experienced through through mindfulness of the body, especially through the dukkha door, realizing that there's so much suffering with this body. Having a body is not an easy thing. So there's more I had to say. Well, I've written down about talking about anicca, dukkha, and anatta, because the body can be a doorway. Maybe I'll just say one sentence before moving to the questions, because I do want to answer a few of the questions since I asked for them this morning so nicely and you provide it. So just one thing to say also about mindfulness of the body. So the three characteristics of existence, the three marks of existence, if you haven't heard them before practicing Buddhism: anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Anicca, impermanence; dukkha, unsatisfactoriness and anatta, not self. Some people translate it as no self, but I don't think that's a really good translation. Actually, not self is a much better one, because it basically the teaching is that there is no abiding self. There is no continuing. How should I put it? The best way to think about it is that this self, this being, is a process. So if we say no self, it almost seems like we're denying that we exist. And the teaching is not supposed to be a denial of our existence. Yes, we exist. We have an address. We have preferences. We have a body, etc. But not self is really an idea of this self as a mirage, as a process of all these different factors coming together. So the body can be a doorway to experiencing impermanence. You can experience the feelings, the sensations that come and go every moment, both in the momentary sense and also in the long-term sense. You can experience dukkha or unsatisfactoriness. The body does not stay satisfactory. If you're feeling really good right now sitting, well, try sitting and not moving for an hour. It will become unsatisfactory. It will become painful. And perhaps not self is most easy to see. Anatta is most easy to see through the doorway of the body, because not self is also translated as uncontrollability, because you don't have control over your body. Can you tell your body not to age? Can you tell your body not to get sick? When you're sitting in the hall and your stomach starts to make gurgling sounds and you're embarrassed and you want it to stop, can you tell your body to stop making gurgling sounds? It's anatta, it's not self. Can really see that this body isn't self. What we think we have a lot of control over, we don't have control over. And mindfulness of the body can open us up for these insights with capital I. So I want to switch now to the questions. So this one I already answered. What do you recommend if overwhelmed by sexual images during meditation? What do you do? Come on, try again. 32 parts of the body. Good work, yes. Or simplification is? The three parts of the body. Good, you got that one. Okay, great. So another question is, these are out of order. I have some notes here. I'll take this one. So how do you find peace and hope when we are living in a world with so much unconsciousness, violence, greed, and selfishness, not to mention degradation of the planet? So, pretty light topic. Thought I would take this one. So it's interesting. Richard and I were talking about the questions also over lunch, there is a book by Steven Pinker, and some of you might be familiar with this. The name of the book is The Better Angels of Our Nature: Why Violence Has Declined. It came out in 2011, and basically in the book he argues that violence in the world has declined both in the long run and in the short run, and basically that right now it's and actually I'll read a little blurb in the summary of it from Wikipedia. Pinker presents a large amount of data and statistical analysis that he argues demonstrate that violence has been in decline over millennia, and that the pr- that the present is probably the most peaceful time in the history of human species. Who would have thought? The decline in violence, he argues, is enormous in magnitude, visible on both long and short scales, and found in many domains, including military conflict, homicide, genocide, torture, criminal justice, treatment of children, homosexuals, animals, racial and ethnic minorities. He stresses that the decline, to be sure, has not been smooth. It has not brought violence down to zero, and it is not guaranteed to continue. So basically, in the book, he argues that over time, there has been a movement overall in humanity towards more empathy, and violence right now, if you look at all these different aspects, has decreased. This is the most peaceful, most loving our human race has ever been, which makes you wonder how it was 100, 200, 300, 400, right, years ago. But that gives me hope. Somehow that gives me hope. It gives me hope that somehow, as human beings, learning to live together on this planet, somehow something has worked to make us more peaceful and less violent towards each other. And hopefully we'll also find a way to wake up about the planet, about the damage we have done to the planet also. Continue to wake up that way. Another question. It seems sadness and probably other emotional states can be a veil or a hindrance in mindfulness meditation. Discuss, please. So it's interesting because I think the word veil and hindrance, I see them a little differently. For them, they have very different nuances for me. Veil, sadness, could be something that is hiding something else underneath. And a lot of times we have emotions where there is some another emotion underneath, and as we sit with them, as we're mindful in the body, we see that the veil of sadness is actually hiding something else. Maybe it is disappointment or something else, or something else that needs to come up and be processed. Hindrance also is an interesting word, because there are the five hindrances. The hindrances and the five basically wanting, desire, which is wanting, pulling forwards, and the opposite of that is pushing, ill will or aversion. So one, sensual desire or ill will, those go in a pair. And the other two pair is sloth and torpor that we talked about. Actually, sloth and torpor is one. And then the other side of the pair is anxiousness, anxiety, is restlessness and worry is the other part of that. And then the fifth one is doubt. So these are the classical hindrances that come up during meditation and we work with. So as the questioner has brought the idea of hindrance in, I wanted to bring hindrances in for a moment too, because the way also we practice with the hindrances, say let's take sloth and torpor that we've talked about most on this retreat, you can actually work with them as an object of meditation. You can have curiosity about them. You can learn a lot about your mind by examining what it feels like to be sleepy. What does it feel like in the body? What does it feel like in the mind? So you don't see it as a hindrance, like, something negative I need to get rid of, but something that actually can open you up to learning more. And it's the same about the other ones. With sensual desire, you can learn, why is it coming up again? What is happening? Or aversion or ill will. Let me learn more about the state of my mind, so they can open you up in ways that you work with them skillfully. Not to say they're easy, but working with them can open you up to learning more and becoming more free. So in that way, and also Gil, in his teaching, as he is my mentor, he says it's important not to see the hindrances as a personal failing, and that all human beings have them, and it's just their doorway. They're actually, he uses the word veil, which has also been used here, nivarna, the word actually for hindrance in Pali is nivarna, which is covering, which is a veil, which is something that's covering something that's underneath it. And it's a veil. You work through it and you work with it, and it opens up to freedom, because you gain more freedom than if you just try to get rid of it. But you work with it. It becomes the object of your practice. So even hindrances are not a hindrance. That's kind of a complicated word, right? I use hindrances because in the teachings, you refer to these five things as hindrances, but really coverings is a better way. Now, to come back to the question about sadness and other emotional states, sadness is just sadness. It can be a doorway to seeing what is underneath. And it's not so much something that's keeping you away from mindfulness, keeping you away from being mindful. You can be mindful of it. It can become the doorway, can become the object. It can be held in mindfulness. And also, in that way, it can expand our capacity for being human and holding more and more and more and not being fazed by it. It's just sadness. It's just sadness. It comes and goes. So I want to share with you the poem that you've probably all heard a million times, translated. It's a Rumi poem called The Guest House, translated by Coleman Barks. But it's so appropriate here. And since I'm Persian, I want to bring it in. I have quoting rights. Also, what I want to do is I want to share the first three lines of it in Farsi with you, because it's a beautiful language. And also because Coleman Barks takes a lot of literary freedom. And he takes different poems of Rumi from different places and combines them. And he inserts his own creativity, and which is beautiful. I love Coleman Barks' language. It's floral, and it really lands, but it's a little sometimes different from what Rumi wrote. So I'll offer you which one should I offer you first? I'll offer you the Farsi one first, just for the fun of it. Okay, here we go. Hast mehman khane in tan ay javan, har sabahi zayf no ayad davan. هین مگو کین مانند اندر گردنم که همکنون باز پرد در عدم. I'll read that again. هین مگو کین مانند اندر گردنم که همکنون باز پرد در عدم. هرچه آید از جهان غیب وش در دلت زیف است او را دار خش. Anyway, for whatever it's worth, you can hear Rumi now in its original language. Some people have told me that they appreciate hearing that, because there's a rhythmicity that's beautiful, even though if I can't deliver it very well. So Coleman Barks translates that as, this being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door, laughing, and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. I can do my own translation, but I think we have limited time, so I'd rather answer more questions another time. So let's see. A couple of quick ones. One is, Can you offer a simple mindfulness mantra when mindfulness of breath is being taken over by monkey mind? When the stories aren't important enough to focus on, but they remain on the forefront of your sit. So for this particular case exactly, when the stories aren't important enough, but they kind of like, they're coming and visiting, I actually do have a little mantra that I use. Surprise. And what I do is I basically say, with as much gentleness as I can muster, I say, not now. I basically bow to them, not now, not now. Basically trusting that you'll still be there, you monkey thoughts, you'll be there. But right now, I'm busy meditating, not now. I'll come back to you later, not now. It's just a very simple. And if you decide to use it, make sure you don't use it in the way of, not now. It's not supposed to be not now. It's supposed to be very gentle, like, not now. Not now, thank you. Very gentle, not now. So that's that. When is it okay to indulge in imaginative or creative thoughts that feel in the body more exciting and engaging than paying attention to my foot on the floor during walking meditation? It's kind of interesting. It depends. So I think the way it has been written, I'm going to take my cue from the lexical choices. I actually appreciate, there's so much wisdom. I think people who write their questions, a lot of times the answer is there. So I'm thinking of the word, is it, when is it okay to indulge, right? So indulge in imagined or creative thoughts that feel in the body more exciting, in quotes, and engaging. Like, okay, so then my foot on the ground. So I would bring the attention to, is the foot on the ground feeling kind of boring? Is it kind of feeling, is there more, not enough joy in it that the mind is like, I am so done with that foot. I want to go to this exciting thought that is juicy in my body. Like, woo, let's do that. That's much more fun. So that's where I would bring the attention to see what is the quality of the attention. So that's one aspect to see whether we're pushing the mind too much, whether there's not enough joy, whether we've lost that curiosity and awe and openness about the sensations, about what we're actually doing, that the mind just wants to go on a holiday instead of, you know, wants to plan the next vacation, but it's actually juicy, exciting thought and it's creative. And so that's one place to pay attention to. Maybe that's enough. I'll leave that. And if there's more, ask me. I guess maybe I'll say one more thing about that. And that is, if imaginative or creative thoughts, it's good to not think or not feel that mindfulness is at odds with creativity. And in fact, when the mind is more settled, a lot more creativity can arise, but there is a right time and place for it. If you've decided that you're giving yourself, you're wholeheartedly giving yourself to the meditation to see what it can open up as, then going after that imaginative and creative thought might actually be a diversion. It's a way to check out. So I'll leave that for your own exploration. If you have any thoughts or suggestions about returning to our daily lives after a residential retreat, we'll talk more about that, both Richard and myself. And I did mention the practices of the body, basically body posture and activities. Those are two good things, and I'll say more about them. And let's see. Maybe I'll have time to just add one more. Okay. I don't know that if it fits the theme of the retreat, but could you speak to the luminous mind? And I think I'll close my talk with that, and I'll just read the luminous mind from the Papasara Sutta. Pabhasara Sutta. Can I say that 10 times fast? Pabhasara Sutta. It's translated by Tanisara Bhikkhu. Luminous, monks, is the mind, and it is defiled by incoming defilement. Luminous, monks, is the mind, and it is freed from incoming defilements. Luminous, monks, is the mind, and it is defiled by incoming defilements. The uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person doesn't discern that as it actually is present, which is why I tell you that, for the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person, there is no development of the mind. Luminous, monks, is the mind, and it is freed from incoming defilements. The well-instructed disciple of the noble ones discerns that as it actually is present, which is why I tell you that, for the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones, there is development of the mind. So basically, luminous is the mind. So the mind, in its natural state, is bright, free, luminous. Just lovely. And sometimes, on retreat, when we practice, and practice at home, we can have a glimpse of this luminous mind that is not defiled by these incoming defilements, by this and that and the other thing. And it's just free and it's open and we just experience it. And there is a moment of completeness, contentment, ease, just experiencing the mind and its complete luminosity and beauty. Which is why we are here together developing our mind to experience that luminosity, that ease and that freedom. Let's just sit together for just a few seconds and let the words settle. Luminous is the mind. Luminous is the mind. And it is freed from incoming defilements. Thank you for your kind attention. I hope this was of some service and some use for your practice.